Welcome to the first sustainability podcast of the Budapest Center for Long-Term Sustainability, BC4LS, and Paulos Athenaeus Books. Angus Forbes, a former city banker who turned into a leading environmentalist, raises awareness of the accelerating destruction of the biosphere. With his groundbreaking volume, Angus Forbes offers both captivating reasons and a comprehensive solution for saving the planet. In this podcast, Gábor Gyura, head of the Sustainable Finance Department of the Central Bank of Hungary, has a discussion with Angus Forbes, author of The Global Planet Authority.
Good morning, Angus, and we really appreciate that you accepted our invitation for this discussion, for this podcast. And actually, personally, I'm really glad that we can talk about your book, The Global Planet Authority. I think many great books and scientific studies have been published recently about how serious environmental anomalies such as climate change are. But I think there are very few of them which actually suggest a solution, something tangible, something practical, but also something comprehensive and with sufficient ambition to tackle really the problem. And I really enjoyed reading your book. I think it's both a bit pessimistic and realistic, but also very optimistic by offering a solution and actually an out-of-the-box solution to all these problems. But reading your book made me curious about some of the backgrounds. And I think our readers will be quite keen again to learn about some of the things in the background that led you to write the book as you did it. So first of all, probably it would be great to start with your motivations. One could be wondering, what was your number one reason to write this book, and why did you write this book at the specific time as you did it?
Well, thanks, Gábor. It's a complete pleasure to be here. So thank you so much for inviting me. Yes, I wrote the book about 4 years ago, so probably 2017 now, Global Planet Authority. It was a combination of having worked in the city of London in finance for 20 years. And then immediately after that, I started a green fund when I was still there. But then immediately after that, I got very heavily into sustainability and I met some brilliant people. Absolutely brilliant people along the way. A gentleman called Lord Stern, who wrote a very famous report, the Stern Report, saying that climate change was the largest market failure of all time. Jonathan Porritt, who founded Friends of the Earth. People in the city who are launching sustainability funds, the founders of Generation Asset Management, Al Gore and David Blood and Mark Ferguson. And overall, when I observed their brilliance and their efforts, the statistics were still getting worse. So I was going, oh, hold on, if these brilliant people are committing themselves and yet the statistics of biophysical degradation are getting worse, then there must be at least another part of the solution that we're missing. And I suppose having grown up as a son of a diplomat, I've been watching the world for a long time, the geopolitics and how people behave. And it was that combination of knowing that we're all just humans and we all get along, actually, and we all share so much that I felt that it was natural for humanity to consider the next step, which is to step up into global governance above the nation state for the first time, to put in a specialist agency to protect our greatest common asset, which is the globe. In football, we have FIFA. In athletics, we have the IOC. In netball, we have the International Netball Federation. These are specialist, dedicated agencies whose only job is to protect and improve the game. And I think we should entertain such a move as humanity at this time.
Actually, in your book, and I guess also that's, again, shedding also some light on your motivations, of course, you offer a very detailed diagnosis of basically how serious the problem is. And actually, nowadays, I think many people talk about the existential threats humanity is facing. And it's, of course, not just environmental problems, but right now we are talking in the middle of a global pandemic, and there are also other threats. So where does climate change and environmental degradation fit into this environmental existential risk profile that, that humanity is facing?
Well, Gabor, that's a really good question. Everything changed when we dropped the atomic bomb in 1945. The risk profile to humanity, literally, if there was a chart, it inverted in August 1945. So the three big bad boys, if I could call them, that we're living with at the moment is nuclear annihilation, potential of, climate change, which of course is the degradation of the troposphere, and environmental degradation as a whole, those three. But they are just about to be surpassed or augmented by three worse ones, or that compound the risk at least. And that is unaligned AI, dystopian scenarios where we have a lack of trust amongst humans and of that, and engineered pandemics. And so the people that profile humanity's total existential risk are people like Toby Ord at Oxford University or Martin Rees at Cambridge University. They are saying we're going down a steep slope as this century progresses, because the six of them will come together to make material existential risk. And I love the quote by Toby Ord. He says, only heroic action in institutional building will deflect that path. So we have to imagine the new institutions that we want to build as a race to make sure that we don't face such a risk. And as he reminds us as well, is with existential risk, you don't get a second chance. So you need to build an institution or a series of institutions that mean that you never come to face that risk, ever. And I think this leads really interestingly with regard to climate change and environmental degradation. What we now know as a body of people alive at the moment, that we have moved to an advanced position of the human environmental nexus. For in the first time in human history, we now run a planet with Mother Nature. It's never happened before because we're so strong. I play around and say, well, imagine if we decided to nuke the Himalayas down to rubble and then truck it all and fill in the Mediterranean. As a race, we could probably do that if we put our minds to it over, let's say, 50 years. So we are now in an incredibly strong position. That is the first realization. We run the planet with Mother Nature. But the realization that's just about to occur, I believe, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, is that it never stops. Assuming we hold this level of power, which is new, it will never stop. We will still need to take care of the planet in aggregate in the year 2122, and in the year 2400, and in the year 2700, because it's a new reality. So seeing as we have this new reality, let's put in an agency capable of removing that particular existential risk.
Yeah, you mentioned realization, and actually scientists, I think, have been warning us for now a couple of decades how serious the problem is. But do you think there is sufficient awareness in humanity about the seriousness of problems? I mean, among everyday citizens who are basically electing governments and officials, And if so, then how do you see the reasons behind the global failure to really establish international partnership, a governance structure that could really effectively fight climate change?
I think the awareness is there. The press is fully open. I think just in our adult lifetimes, if you're 40 or 50 years old, you would have noticed a material change in the press. 20 years ago, an environmental story would hardly make the front cover. Now, the moment the last pink dolphin in the Chinese River dies, it's on the front pages. And the moment there's a heat wave in Seville or in California, it's on the front pages. So humanity knows about the risk. Okay, imagine that the whole human race is in a spaceship. And we're zooming around space and it's dark and it's cold and there's no noise and there's no smell. And we land on planet Earth in 2021, right? And we spill out of our spaceship and we sink to our knees. We cannot believe that this planet, which is at 14.3 degrees and has tigers and bears and elephants and savanna and rainforest, we cannot believe it. Once we've got over our euphoria, the leadership group says to the 7.7 billion, hey guys, how are we going to protect this incredible thing, this life support mechanism for the next 1,000 years? Nobody in their right mind would say, hey, I've got a good idea. Let's split it up into 195 parts. Let's make the leaders not specialists, because they're specialists in human goods provision, but not in biophysical care. They don't have any money. They're part-time, they're amateurs. The bottom line is that the system that we have is structurally flawed, because it was built by our foreparents, by our forebears, to deal with the problems of their time. They needed armies, they needed cultural togetherness. We've got to remember how young the nation state system is. I'm sorry, I don't know how old Hungary is in its latest incarnation. But Germany was only born in 1881, Italy in 1882, the Federal Australia in 1900, the Republic of China in 1911, the People's Republic in 1947. Our nation states are babies in time, and they're not designed with a specific job of protecting a whole biosphere. And that's what we have to face up to now and give the job to specialists.
And actually, your suggestion for these specialists is really to set up a global planet authority. And actually, you describe for us in the book the governance structure, how this authority could work in practice, how it could really reflect the priorities of all continents and regions of the world. And I think, and you do provide also kind of the road how to get there. But I would just really be curious again, a little bit more about how you really see the chances of humanity getting there to have such an authority. And I'm especially curious about, would you expect something, a sudden change triggering very drastically these changes, or would it be something more gradual? Will it be geopolitical events or a financial crisis, or what could really lead us there to have such an authority? What do you think?
Thanks, Kamal. If there is one part of this podcast that I would like to emphasize, it's the next part, which, and it's a number actually, it's the ratio of 100 to 1. That is the key thing. And what I'm referring to there is that by the end of this decade, we will have 5 billion people who are middle class, according to the Brookings Institute, the EU, and the Pew Institute. 5 billion people will be earning $10 a day or more, which is the definition of middle class, according to the UN. So for the first time in humanity, we will have a huge, globally connected middle class of 5 billion people. And then one has to ask oneself, how many people actually run and enforce the nation state system? How many people actually do that? And the answer is 50 million. There's only 21 million soldiers in the world. And then if you take 30 million most senior civil servants who uphold the highest levels of institutional form of the judiciary, executive and operating arms of all the governments, you get 30 million. If you take and compute that by 5,000 MPs of the world, give them 500 senior civil servants each, that's 25 million. So because we're an efficient race, we let 50 million people run and enforce our 195 nations. That's fine because we all want to go and play tennis or study economics or do other things, right? Or feed our families or be farmers. But that ratio of 5 billion to 50 million or 100 to 1, which we've just hit for the first time at the global level, is the magic number. Because it's the average of the most famous acts of revolutionary change of the last 250 years. It was 26 to 1 in America in 1776. It was 50 to 1 in South Africa in 1994. It was 90 to 1 in France in 1790. It was 100 to 1 in Russia in 1917. And it was 300 to 1 in India in the end of the British Raj. The average is 100 to 1. And we are just hitting it now. And it invokes the possibility by the middle class. What can we do? What can we build? Where can we go together? We can go past anybody. We have so much power as a collective. Now you asked, what would the conditions be? For revolutionary change, you normally have four standard elements. You have the dissidents who are provoking the idea. That's what we're doing today. And there's a lot more of them. David Attenborough said in a lecture just 3 weeks ago, for the first time I've ever heard him say it publicly, he said we must go past the nation state. But if you look around, Harari, Hawken, Gaia Vince, more and more people are saying we've got to go somewhere else because it's just a structural flaw. The second thing is mass frustration. And that's about to happen because the middle class is going up in their aspiration just as the environment will come down. So they'll get increasingly frustrated as a body of people that they can't continue to increase their crop yields, their wealth, etc. And of course, the press is open and will be reminding them of their risk profile. The third thing is shared motivation. We have to believe where we're going and what we want to build. And that's the work that's about to happen. And the fourth thing is crisis. Well, that is set. So of those four things, dissidents are getting louder. That's a tick. Mass frustration is about to occur. That's a tick. Shared motivation is the question mark. And crisis will occur between 2030 and 2050. That is also a tick. So we have three out of four so far.
And let's assume that we arrive at having such a global solution for these problems. But even if we had such a global authority, of course, action would still need to take place on the local level, on the individual level. So I was just wondering what kind of local or individual actions or solutions do you believe in personally? What kind of good practices do you see already happening or what could happen in the future?
It's an all-out change, isn't it? I love the computation done by Professor Marley of Oxford and his team. They computed the natural planetary metabolism natural planetary metabolism, which is the amount that the Earth grows, the plants grow, and the energy that's absorbed, and the animals procreate. And they worked that out. It's incredible. I don't quite understand it, but they did. And what they said, what's easier to compute is the aggregate human industrial metabolism. How heavy we are, how many Coke bottles we produce, how many Teslas we produce, how many buildings we make, you know, and of course we have the calculation of GDP. And what they said is that the industrial metabolism of our mankind has reached and surpassed that of nature, which means that it's a bit like a Coke, a glass of full fat Coke next to a glass of water. And we're just putting more and more Coca-Cola into the glass and it slops over into the water and it degrades it. So what we have to do is reduce our aggregate industrial metabolism. So anything that becomes lighter is better. Less carbon in the car, ingrained carbon or emitting carbon. Nanocellulose is going to be so exciting. Nanocellulose is using wood fiber, but bonding it in really cleverly, and it's seven times stronger than steel and seven times lighter. So it's very likely that the Volkswagen that you will drive in 2035 will be made of wood. Won't be made of steel because it'll be made of nanocellulose. So when you cast your eye across, let's say, the whole of Hungary, you can see it. What plastic is biodegradable and what is not? Where are they substituting in bamboo and wood? Are you buying your cotton earbuds, the ones, you know, that ladies may apply their makeup or you might clean your ears? Is there no plastic in that? You'll know these things and you can feel us getting lighter right across the board, everything. Our roads, we are practicing making roads, aren't we, using plastic, recycled plastic rather than bitumen. So there's such an exciting future as we all swing to having a lighter footprint.
And let's maybe close by a more personal question. I think your book does offer a lot of encouragement and inspiration that actually things are not lost. We can change things, but I'm curious, what gives you encouragement, inspiration, energy to give others inspiration and encouragement with all these dire topics such as climate change and environmental degradation?
Thank you. I know it's so often quoted, and maybe it's even a bit of a cliche now, but the famous words by Gandhi that you must never lose faith in humanity. If humanity's progress is like a fish swimming, in order for a fish to go straight, both sides of the tail must flap. It must flap left, it must flap right, it must flap left, it must flap right. For the last 2,000 years, we have only been flapping with one side of the tail, which is the male side. The future must be female. And of the 5 billion global citizens who will be middle class, half will be women. And I believe that the women will come together. They will allocate their personal sovereignty en masse, and they will lead us into global governance above the nation state in order to save humanity.
Thank you very much, Angus. And let's indeed hope that the fish of humanity can really achieve sustainable progress. Once again, we are really grateful that you could join us to share your thoughts. And I'm sure our listeners will all agree that we very much look forward to reading more thoughts from you in the future.
Thank you for your kind attention. If you enjoyed our program, please join us at our next sessions as well. This podcast was produced by the team of BC4LS and Pobooks. If you haven't yet had the chance to get hold of the Hungarian version of the Global Planet Authority, we would like to offer you the ebook version for free. Please visit the webshop of Paulos Otene Books, www.paulosotenekiado.com. sustainability.hu and type in the word sustainability in the promotion code field. This offer is available for a limited time only, so don't miss out and enjoy the book.